Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kamara-Sami. It is nearly a week since Israel announced a daily pause in military activity in part of southern Gaza to make it easier for aid trucks to enter the Gaza Strip via the main Kerem Shalom crossing point. But that pause has not meant that the fighting has stopped in other parts of the territory. Today, Hamas said that Israeli airstrikes on neighbourhoods in Gaza City had killed at least 38 people. The Israeli military says that warplanes struck Hamas military infrastructure sites. It comes a day after 22 people died in the Mawasi area of the southern Gaza city of Rafah when a shell struck an area where displaced people were sheltering near the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross. The Red Cross has not said who it thinks was responsible. The Israeli military has said the incident is under review, but an initial inquiry found there was no direct attack carried out by the IDF against a Red Cross facility. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has called for an independent investigation and for those responsible to be held accountable. Well, families of the victims of Friday's attack gathered outside a hospital in the town of Khan Yunis. Among them was Mona Ashour, who lost her husband.
We were inside our tent when a sound bomb exploded near the Red Cross tents. My husband went outside at the first explosion. Then a second bomb went off, even closer to the Red Cross door, and people began to gather. I tried to communicate with my husband, but was unable to. We fled as we were, in our clothes and barefoot. I tried again to communicate with my husband, but couldn't find him.
William Schomburg is head of the International Committee of the Red Cross delegation in Gaza, and he spoke to me from its office in Al-Mawazi, where Friday's attack took place.
I mean, the scenes that we witnessed yesterday were tragic, horrific. I'm running out of adjectives to describe just how painful it was. There were several extremely loud explosions very close to where we are located. We are talking really just a few meters away from us. Several dead and wounded directly in front of our office, which was also partially damaged by the impact of these blasts. We were then able to transfer many of the casualties to the nearby Red Cross Field Hospital.
Just to confirm, were you there when it happened?
I was indeed.
And have you processed what happened?
I think after, you know, going on 9 months of war, it's an extremely difficult situation for anybody to process. I think particularly for our Palestinian colleagues and civilians within Gaza who have borne the brunt of this conflict, consistently having to deal with a lack of access to healthcare, very intensified hostilities, particularly around Rafah in recent weeks, as well as huge shortages in basic commodities. The burden of this conflict is too great for too many.
I mean, what does this do to your work?
I mean, practically speaking, I mean, the International Red Cross, the ICRC, will do everything that we can to remain operational and to meet the humanitarian consequences of this conflict for civilians. We have had close calls in the past, and we cannot have more close calls. It is a question of life or death, and it is frankly a miracle that yesterday none of our staff were seriously harmed or injured. So, of course, we'll now need to think about what we can do for our teams to make sure that they can continue to run the hospital as well as the other programs that we have across the Gaza Strip.
Are you having to rethink the arrangements you have in place with the warring parties to ensure that this kind of attack on or near your offices doesn't happen?
Of course, you know, we want to bring attention to this situation because the safety of our team is at risk, and we do everything that we can to secure their security through dialogue with all parties to the conflict. And it's fundamental that for the International Red Cross, like any other humanitarian actor, we fundamentally need those security guarantees in order for us to deliver.
What sort of conversations, communications have you had since yesterday's incident?
The communications that the International Red Cross has with the parties to the conflict forms part of a bilateral and confidential dialogue. But of course, we do everything that we can, both at the level of our office here in Rafah, but also through our colleagues based inside of Israel, in Geneva, and in other major world capitals, where we are speaking as regularly as we can and ensuring that we try to engage and mobilize the parties and those who have influence over them, so that we can continue doing our job.
Do you have any idea at this stage who was responsible for what happened yesterday?
Look, we're speaking about this today because it was a severe security incident after many close calls in the past and a tragic loss of civilian life. But what we are not here to do is to lay blame. And I think that we want to focus squarely on the outcome of this incident, to treat the wounded, and to ensure to the extent possible that there will not be a repetition of such an incident in the future.
And just to be absolutely clear, this came completely out of the blue, did it? There was no sense of there was no warning. There was nothing that led you to believe that you needed to take shelter.
Nowhere is safe in Gaza at any moment. Throughout the day and night, we are constantly hearing crossfire, explosions, other types of hostilities that often feel that they are within close proximity to us. So, of course, there is a level of risk that we try to the extent to mitigate by operating here because of how important the impact is of our work. But nevertheless, with this incident specifically, we had no prior understanding that something would occur as close to us as it did yesterday.
And as you said, victims were people, understand, who were sort of sheltering in tents nearby. They come to Red Cross facilities because they believe that these are safer places. Is that going to change, do you think, as a result of this?
Look, we will continue wherever we can to provide services and support to those who are the most in need. But it is ultimately the responsibility of the parties to the conflict to ensure the protection of civilians under humanitarian law.
You have been clear and careful not to blame anyone for this. The Israeli military says it is reviewing the situation. But we do know in the past, Israel has accused Hamas of putting their operatives in amongst the civilian population. Have you seen any evidence of Hamas amongst those who are sheltering near your office?
What I know is that when I look out of my office, I see tents with families, with children in them, with mothers trying to cook meals using whatever they can find on the depleted local market, and dozens of my own staff members and their families who themselves have been displaced and live in, frankly, very tough conditions, trying to look after their loved ones while at the same time continuing their humanitarian mission with the Red Cross. That is what I see around me, Joseph.
And that was William Schomburg from the International Committee of the Red Cross speaking to me from the Al-Mawasi area of Rafah in southern Gaza. Well, as the killing continues in Gaza, the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has warned that escalating hostilities along Israel's northern border with Lebanon could lead to a catastrophe for the region and beyond. The Iran-backed Lebanese group Hezbollah began firing missiles into Israel after the attacks of October the 7th in support of its Palestinian ally Hamas. Israel has responded by striking Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. In recent days, the military activity and the rhetoric have become more intense. And our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to the Israeli side of the border, from where she sent this report.
It's problem in here.
David Kamari's neighbours are long gone. The roofs of their houses smashed by shrapnel from Hezbollah rockets. David has stayed on in the largely deserted border town of Kiryat Shmona. Even now, weeks after a rocket hit his front garden, cracking his house in several places and filling it with rubble.
You were here.
I live here. This is my home.
And when the Katyusha came through?
I stand here.
He shows me the gaping holes where shrapnel slice through the walls, missing him by inches.
You see the wall?
Yeah. That's the small one.
And big here.
The big one over there.
1 meter.
And points to the hills above us, where Hezbollah-controlled territory begins.
Every day, every night, bomb, problem. And I born here. What I say? Look, Hezbollah, kill Hezbollah. If you live here one night, you go crazy. Very, very strong, very problem. Bombs, rockets. Why?
Rockets hit Kiryat Shmona every week. One slipped past Israel's defences days ago, hitting a street outside the mayor's office.
And hit here.
Yeah, hit and there and there and one there.
The US is pushing hard for a diplomatic solution here. But the mayor, Avichai Stern, says full-scale war is the only way out.
Sitting here like lambs to slaughter, just waiting for the day they attack us like we saw in the south, it's unacceptable. And everyone understands the choice is between war now or war later. I don't think there is any country in the world that would accept daily fire against its citizens.
Israeli strikes into southern Lebanon have displaced more than 90,000 people on the Lebanese side of the border. But some have stayed, saying it's better to die at home with dignity than be driven out of their land like the Palestinians. Fear of all-out war extends as far as the capital, Beirut, where some say they keep suitcases packed and passports ready in case full-scale war breaks out.
Of course we don't want to go to war with Israel, but if that's solidarity with the people in Gaza, so be it.
I went to the south a few days ago. You wonder if the highway will get hit on the way back. But am I going to stop for everything? Life doesn't stop.
Of course, everyone is afraid, and those who tell you they are not are lying to themselves.
Hezbollah is a well-trained, well-armed military, backed by Iran. Its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, has threatened to invade Israel if full-scale war breaks out, and says nowhere in the country will be spared. But Israel has been talking up its readiness to take them on. Tough talk is part of both sides' strategy of deterrence, but the line between deterrence and decision on a war is becoming harder to see. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing growing demands at home for a ceasefire in Gaza.
We want Hamas gone, we want the hostages gone, and we want to feel safe in our country.
That would help calm tensions in the north too. But Mr. Netanyahu is keeping both conflicts going, mortgaged by his promise to far-right government allies to destroy Hamas before ending the Gaza war. Playing for time is his specialty. But the longer this conflict goes on, the more it turns into playing with fire.
And that was Lucy Williamson reporting from northern Israel. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kumarasamy. And coming up later on in the programme, Priyanka Gandhi, the daughter and granddaughter of assassinated Indian prime ministers, has said she is seeking a seat in Parliament for the main opposition Congress Party. We'll ask a senior figure from that party whether this is just a continuation of old dynastic politics.
No one is forcing someone to occupy a place. We're going to the people. If the voters, in their collective wisdom, 2.5 million of them, elect an individual multiple times, we have to then give credit to the wisdom and the choice of the people. And Priyanka Gandhi, I can tell you, she campaigned relentlessly across the country. And if anyone should be in parliament, it's her.
Headlines at this hour. Hamas says Israeli airstrikes on residential areas in northern Gaza have killed 38 people. Israel said it was targeting military infrastructure. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. When space debris falls to Earth, it's meant to glide gently into the ocean. But with the final frontier an increasingly crowded place these days, the chances of something going wrong when space junk comes down to Earth are going up. The Otero family in Florida knows about that only too well. In March, what turned out to be a chunk of NASA support equipment fell through the roof of their house, causing damage, but luckily no injuries. Well, now in the first case of its kind, the family is claiming damages from NASA. Joining us now on the line is the lawyer who's representing the family, Micah Winworthy, a partner at Cranfield Sumner and chair of that firm's Aviation and Aerospace Practice Group. Welcome to NewsHour.
Thank you for having me.
This is a first, isn't it? I think both the damage, but also the fact that you are claiming damages in this way.
This is absolutely the first. There's definitely been a history of space debris that has been falling, in various countries. But in the United States, this is the first of its kind where the space debris has actually caused damages. And therefore, this is the first opportunity that NASA has had to receive a claim regarding those damages.
And that is key, I think, isn't it? Because there is an International Space Liability Convention, but this is the fact that it's happened in America and it's American space junk that's involved, which makes it such an interesting legal case.
It is. Yes, this is really fascinating to especially the legal scholars, because there's two legal regime sort of at play here. On the one hand, yes, you've got the intersection of international law. And if this incident had happened where it was a United States or a NASA originated piece, but it had injured someone in a foreign country, under the Space Liability Convention, the U.S. would have been absolutely liable, which is a strict liability standard for those damages. However, in the United States, on the other side of the legal regimes, we have the concept of sovereign immunity, and the United States government allows only claims to be filed against itself for torts, which typically mean negligence. So in this case, in my claim for the Alteros, we implored NASA to consider that it has already, the United States has already committed to a absolute liability standard when it comes to its space objects.
And what are the claim? What is the claim for exactly?
Sure. So there's a component here that is non-insured damages, which relate to the Otero's the impact that they had on their ability to continue working. Mr. Otero actually was working from the home, and so he had business interruption dealing with the whole event. And that's part of his story, is that it was quite bewildering in the beginning to even understand how to make a claim, or how to even identify who to make the claim to, that this incident had happened. So he engaged legal counsel specifically to navigate that process. And so he's making a claim, and his family's making a claim for the non-insured damages, which included the business interruption, the non-insured property damage, and then also the mental and emotional anguish and the toll that it had on the family.
And briefly, I mean, this is going to set some sort of precedent. I mean, we hope there won't be many instances of this kind, but there could be.
Well, we don't expect there to be an onslaught of these types of cases. There's certainly very smart people and many countries who are actually dedicated to looking at the issues with the space debris situation right now, and looking at this problem. But this is precedent setting, because however NASA responds to this claim is going to set the standard. It will send a strong signal to both private and public enterprises on this type of issue.
Micah Winworthy, thank you very much indeed. Now we're going to turn to what is the final qualifying day for the quirkiest of American contests. That is the annual 4th of July Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Competition, when contestants gather in New York's Coney Island to down as many hot dogs as they can in 10 minutes. Not that it's been much of a contest for the past decade and a half, though. Joey Chestnut from San Diego has won 16 of the past 17 Nathan's competitions. I was actually there for his first win in 2007 over the then reigning champ, Takeru Kobayashi.
66 hot dogs in one!
So history has been made. Joey Chestnut has broken the world record, and he has claimed the mustard belt back for the United States of America on July the 4th.
Yes, exciting stuff. This year, though, there will be no Joey. The king of the competitive eating circuit has been banned from taking part after signing an endorsement deal with a company which makes plant-based products. Well, Jamie Loftus is a comedian and author of Raw Dog, The Naked Truth About Hot Dogs, and she's been telling me a bit more about the competition.
The Nathan's Hot Dog Contest is a big deal for one day out of a year. Outside of that, no one cares about professional eating in the U.S. It really is this one day that's televised on ESPN. You know, on July 5th, Joey Chestnut becomes a civilian again. Like, he's a celebrity for one day a year.
And it's a bit of July the 4th Americana, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting tracking the sort of growth of this contest over the years, because you have to sift through a lot of misinformation to get to the real story of, well, how long has this contest existed? Because if you ask Major League Eating, who runs this contest, they will say this contest has been going on for over 100 years, which is absolutely not true. It's been going on since about the 70s. And it's a marketing event originally. Over time, it has sort of snowballed into having greater meaning.
Look, Joey Chestnut, he's been at the top of this particular game for some time. Tell us a bit about him. I was there when he won it for the first time, but I haven't followed every year as closely as you've done since. What sort of a character is he? How has he become so popular?
Joey is an incredible eater. I adore him. I love him. But the reason that he is as prominent as he is because Takeru Kobayashi, who is the previous champion, which I know you know, I'm so jealous you got to see him, came over to the U.S. from Japan, where, you know, professional eating was already popular on TV, and basically single-handedly made this Nathan's contest an event. He's a small guy, and the way that he eats is very deliberate. And now you're hard pressed to find any American eater that isn't directly pulling from him. He, you know, I think single-handedly made the contest as popular as it is today. It became clear over a period of years, especially when Joey Chestnut came in, there was a subtext to it of, you know, Major League Eating would prefer to have a white American champion to a Japanese champion. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's a really fascinating way that Joey Chestnut came to mean what he does mean.
But of course, the Chestnut-Kobayashi rivalry is going to be rekindled, isn't it?
I'm so excited. Yes. Yes. I'm thrilled that they're having a rematch.
I suppose the other question is, can Nathan's, the original contest, survive without Joey Chestnut?
I'm really curious. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me about the contest that it feels like the public coverage doesn't really get into is that the hot dog eating contest is essentially run like professional wrestling. Like, there is a lot of theater and a lot of fiction to the way that these characters are presented. What I hope they do is give some precedence to the figures within that contest that have been historically, you know, ignored. Or, I mean, the women's contest is a great example. When the contest started up through the early 2010s, all genders competed together, and then they were intentionally separated. And so now they have this opportunity, by losing their champion eater, to restructure this contest, to have it be more inclusive and, like, have it be more of what they're claiming to celebrate.
And that was hot dog historian and comedian Jamie Loftus. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Welcome back to NewsHour. There was a major Russian attack on Ukraine's power grid overnight, part of a recent sustained assault by Moscow on the country's energy infrastructure, which has led to a series of rolling blackouts. Ukrainian officials say that two energy workers were taken to hospital in Zaporizhia in the south of the country, while equipment was also damaged in Lviv in western Ukraine. President Zelensky has said that half of Ukraine's electricity generating capacity has been destroyed since Russia began targeting the infrastructure in late March. Dr. Aura Sabadius is an energy expert at the Independent Commodity Intelligence Services. So how serious was the overnight barrage?
It's very serious. This is the eighth massive attack on the energy infrastructure since March, and this is more than half of the Ukrainian electricity capacity. And we're talking here not just generating capacity, power plants, but also transmission lines, substations, etc. So it's very serious. There are rolling blackouts, and there are fears that Ukraine could see more blackouts than actual access to the electricity throughout the day.
So what can Ukraine do in response?
It's not, in fact, Ukraine. It's the West could provide more Patriot systems. Romania provided one earlier this week, but it's certainly not enough. And Ukraine needs a lot of air defenses, because every time Ukrainian engineers repair power plants, the Russians will destroy them. So it's really futile. If there are no air defenses, there's no way that they can repair and keep this capacity going.
Right. And what about storage? What is there?
Gas storage is in Ukraine has the largest storage capacity in Europe, and most of these storage facilities are located in the Lviv region, so it's western Ukraine. Interestingly, these storage facilities have been helping European companies and European consumers, because throughout the years, many companies were injecting gas, were storing gas in Ukraine. And in winter, they were using this gas as backup supplies and really guaranteeing security of supply to European consumers. Now, since these attacks started in March, most of these European companies have started to withdraw the gas from Ukraine because the risk is high. And that means that we have an additional security of supply risk in Europe this winter, potentially.
Yes, I was going to ask about winter. I mean, the initial kind of attacks on the infrastructure were at the beginning of winter. This is obviously happening in summer, but it's storing up problems for the months ahead, is it?
It is indeed. And my suspicion is that Russia is trying to put a lot of pressure on Ukraine to weaken it ahead of winter and to force it into some kind of negotiations.
So that's the bigger picture then, is it?
Indeed.
But on the ground, in terms of what this is going to mean for Ukrainians, we've seen, as you've said, these rolling blackouts. What can Ukrainians expect for the next few months?
Well, I suppose the whole country expects more air defences, because they understand full well that it's impossible to keep the capacity.
That was Dr. Aura Sabadius, an energy expert at the Independent Commodity Intelligence Services. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamarasamy. In what was already billed as the global year of elections, some other unexpected votes have entered the mix. One of them is taking place next Friday in Iran, an early presidential election that was called last month following the death of the previous incumbent Ebrahim Raisi in a helicopter crash. The election campaign is featuring debates about the country's future, including the totemic issue of whether women should be forced to wear the face covering, the hijab. Now, you may remember that the death in 2022 of a young Iranian Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini, who had been detained by the country's morality police for disobeying the Islamic Republic's strict dress rules, sparked Iran's most serious protest movement in years. Tumaj Salehi is a rapper who had supported that movement and whose music captured the imagination of disaffected young Iranians. In particular, that song, Rat Hole, part of a repertoire which resulted in him being sentenced to death in April for corruption on earth. Well, today his lawyer said that Iran's Supreme Court had overturned that death sentence. I've been hearing more about Tumaj Salehi from Nahid Siamdust, an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran.
Tumaj Salehi is a young rapper who came on the scene in September of 2021 with a track that really just went national and then international called Rat Hole, and really set the stage for a change in discourse on the Islamic Republic and the regime in that, you know, it was unapologizing and unapologetic and sort of uncompromising on the notion that the regime simply had to change. And since then, he's produced several tracks, all of which have been very potent in their diction and very much sort of reflective of the sentiments and thoughts of, you know, a large number of Iranians.
But clearly, this was always going to displease the regime.
That's right. I mean, soon after Rat Hole was released, he was taken in by the security forces, kept for about a week, and then released again with promises that, you know, he would keep it quiet. That's how they've handled most regime critics. And for the most part, that's what happens. Tumaj was different in that he didn't do that. He came back on the streets and right away started producing more tracks. And when the Woman Life Freedom Uprising started in October 2022, he produced tracks that reflected the sentiments of the Woman Life Freedom Uprising. And soon after that, he was imprisoned and was kept in jail for about a year. He was only released in late 2023. And again, as soon as he was out, he came out and he released a video in which he detailed the torture that had been done to him. He said, you know, my arms and legs were broken. They broke my fingers. You know, that kind of courage was something that reflected what happened during the Woman Life Freedom Uprising, in that some kind of, you know, wall of fear vis-a-vis the regime is broken.
That real overt challenge to the regime after he was released, that led to him being rearrested and this death sentence being imposed, didn't it?
That's right. He was arrested. His case was going through the courts. But then the Revolutionary Court, which is a sort of parallel judicial system, took over on his case and sentenced him to death. And that's been going on for 2 months. People in Iran have been calling for the sentence to be overturned. You know, he's become a national but also an international icon for the freedom movement in Iran. And just today we heard that the sentence had been overturned by the country's Supreme Court.
What do you make of that decision?
On the one hand, there are elections coming up this week in Iran. And so, you know, my first thought was, you know, the regime tries to get people to come out and vote and to give it more legitimacy in terms of numbers. So maybe this has something to do with the elections. On the other hand, it's possible that the case just took its judicial course and the Supreme Court deemed the sentence to be too harsh. It's hard to know with Iran sometimes.
So what about this election? It's come about because the previous hardline president died in a helicopter crash. Is there any prospect of it bringing some kind of change?
It's hard to tell. I mean, most people would say no. And in fact, the majority of people who have fought for reforms are boycotting the elections. But the Guardian Council did allow one reformist candidate, Pezeshkian, who's really trying to argue that if you want to change the country, you have to stay engaged in these elections. Are they likely to change things? On the one hand, one would think, you know, the Islamic Republic really needs some change because economically it's in the worst shape it's ever been. Politically and socially, there's extreme repression. There's just nothing that gives. This might be an occasion for the Islamic Republic to change course, to allow buy-in from its population, because one would think this, the way it is now, can't really continue forever.
Nahid Siamdust, the author of Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran. The fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg once described herself as living a man's life, but in high heels. The wrap dress she created became a phenomenon in the 1970s as women began to find their own style in the workplace. 50 years on, a new documentary on Disney Plus called Diane von Furstenberg, Woman in Charge, examines the life of the designer credited with reinventing the dress. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, has been to meet the woman known by her initials DVF and the Oscar-winning director of the documentary about her.
DVF.
Fashion tycoon.
Influencer.
Feminist icon.
I did not know what I wanted to do,
But I knew the kind of woman I wanted to be. I wanted to be a woman in charge.
Diane von Furstenberg was a female pioneer in the male-dominated business world.
Yes, I wanted to have a man's life, but I still wanted to be a woman.
A Jewish immigrant to America who became a chat show regular.
Welcome the woman who reinvented the dress.
For the famous wrap dress she created in the early 1970s. It's a stretchy V-neck, wrapped and tied around the waist, that is both flattering and office appropriate.
Jersey fabric molds your body, makes you look proper, but at the same time sexy.
The documentary's director, Charmin Obaid-Shinoy, agrees.
The wrap dress came at a time when high fashion wasn't accessible to everyone. So many women found it liberating. You know, don't spend so much time on all of this. Spend more time doing the things that you love to do.
There's a darker story influencing Diane's life. In the Disney Plus documentary, she reads out the letter her mother hurriedly wrote on a piece of cardboard and threw from the shuttered wagon of the train that took her to Auschwitz.
Mamika et toi, mon petit papa. Votre petite Lily va partir.
She wasn't supposed to survive, and she did survive, and she married my father, and they told him, you cannot have a child. So my birth was a triumph. That my mother used to say, you are my torch of freedom.
Alors, où qu'elle soit, jamais elle ne sera seule ni malheureuse.
My mother would never allow me to be afraid. If I was afraid of the dark, she locks me in the dark closet. Today she could be arrested for that. But as a result, she taught me that fear is not an option. And the other thing is never be a victim.
Charmin Obaid-Shinoy is already a double Oscar winner for her documentaries about women's struggles in Pakistan. She's now moved into the superhero universe. After acclaimed episodes of the TV show Ms. Marvel...
I can't believe it, Bruno. I actually have powers.
I've never seen powers like that.
She is directing the next, and still secret, Star Wars movie.
I've always wanted to tell stories of heroes. In my case, it just so happens that the hero's journey is always a woman.
Is it just so happens, or are you deliberately choosing
well,
that?
Well, I find my inspiration so much in the strength of women. I think that Diane's life is an anthem of freedom. And in the case of Star Wars, it's very much Daisy Ridley, but it's Daisy Ridley and... so many of the characters that we're bringing back into the Star Wars universe, and so many of the characters we're breathing new life into.
Diane von Furstenberg is a survivor who's overcome the threat of bankruptcy more than once, and in the early 90s enlisted the help of the shopping channel QVC.
Silk Assets by Diane von Furstenberg.
I think that I identify very much with what a modern woman.
The documentary starts with an arresting scene. A makeup-free Diane climbing into her bathroom basin to do her face in the mirror.
Yeah.
She doesn't hide the fact she is 77.
Aging is living. So if you have aged, it's already in the bank.
But in an industry that has been obsessed, is obsessed with youth,
well,
what's your answer to how to fix that?
I have never been that way. And maybe it has to do with my mother. My birth was a triumph of life. So every day I have to honour life.
And that was the designer Diane von Furstenberg speaking to the BBC's culture editor Katie Razzle. Now, for more than four decades, the identity of the enigmatic woman whose picture graces the cover of Duran Duran's 1982 album Rio has remained one of pop culture's enduring mysteries. Well, this striking image, created by the late artist Patrick Nagel, has now been definitively linked to a real-life muse through meticulous research by Nagel historian Mark Walker. She has been identified as former model Marcy Hunt, a name previously unknown to Duran Duran fans and the wider public. She is now a vineyard owner in California. And NewsHour's Paul Henley caught up with Marcy Hunt and asked her what it's like to be the actual Rio.
I can tell you, Paul, that it was... an incredible surprise. It's just amazing. It's been a lot of fun. You know, I feel so blessed to be connected with the group, with Duran Duran and the people, of course, who have made the discovery. It's just incredible.
You're an actual Duran Duran fan, aren't you?
I am. They're an incredible group. The fact that they are still making beautiful music, and their music is so complex. Everything that they pull together as musicians may have sounded simple and easy and breezy with Rio, but it really wasn't. And of course, all the girls were, you know, in love with the band naturally at that time.
Can you remember the actual photo that this album cover image was based on? In it, you had a pair of sun specs on, didn't you?
Yes, yes, I do remember the photo. I had many photos, of course, during that time, during the 70s and the 80s when I was living in Paris. I never really thought that the illustration on that well-known cover was a real person. It never occurred to me that, oh, that's me.
That's quite surprising, really, given that you were very familiar with it.
Well, I was familiar with it. What I didn't realize was that Patrick Nagel had taken it from a photo.
Now, if there's a 20-year-old listening who's thinking, what on earth are they talking about? Can you just express why that image, in a way, sums up an early 80s era? It's quite central to a time, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And I think that with the video and with the band, they have so much energy, so much charisma. Everything at that time was glamorous and adventurous. And somehow I think that this photo expresses that.
Her name is actually Marcy Hunt, and she was talking to Paul Henley. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kumarasamy. We learnt this week that Priyanka Gandhi will become the latest member of India's most famous political dynasty to enter electoral politics. She will contest a by-election for one of the two seats won by her brother Rahul Gandhi in the recent parliamentary election, which saw his Indian National Congress party do better than expected. Not well enough to prevent Narendra Modi from continuing as Prime Minister, but forcing Mr. Modi's BJP to govern in coalition. After shedding support in previous elections, Congress stood in this one as part of a multi-party coalition with the acronym INDIA. So, what next for that party in opposition? Sachin Pilot was once its youngest member of parliament. He's now a general secretary of Congress, and he spoke to NewsHour when I was in India for the election. Well, this week, Mr. Pilot was in London, and when he came into the NewsHour studio, I asked him whether he was surprised by the election result.
A little surprised because every exit poll in India was suggesting that the ruling party and its allies would get between 350 or 400 seats. And I knew that the reality was different. On the ground, we could sense that there is a palpable mood for change. And we saw that when the final numbers came out, because we haven't formed the government, but the gap between the opposition and the ruling party has really narrowed down. I think the numbers tell a story that people are not happy with a single party government. That's why the mandate is fractured. How long and how strong the government will be, only time will tell. The parliament session starts next week. But the two allies without whom the government could not be formed will be keenly watched.
Of course, the opposition is also a coalition. And the reason you as a bloc got so many votes is because it's a big coalition and lots of those parties did very well. So is this the future for the Indian opposition? Is it going to be this broad-based coalition-style opposition?
You see, the opposition alliance was formed more than a year and a half ago. Most of them are regional parties, but the Congress, being the pivot of the alliance, I think has a greater responsibility for getting the opposition unity in place. And we've done that. It wasn't easy, I must tell you. A lot of give and take. The numbers today will tell you that the landscape has shifted. What happened in the last 5-7 years of this government would not be allowed to happen anymore, because in parliament there has to be proper debate and discussion and deliberation. So the opposition will remain united, and we've committed ourselves to doing that.
Is there not a danger in this model for Congress that in places where you stood back and let other parties be the figurehead of the alliance, your sort of brand becomes a bit in the background? So in those areas, for example, are you not in danger of actually losing the public's view of you as a party?
I think of these relationships as symbiotic. It's not transactional, and I certainly don't think that we should put our party's self-interest beyond the nation's interest. So we had to have made some compromises, which we have done, I don't think that will stand in the way. We will still obviously make sure that our organization gets strengthened in the areas where we are weak. For example, in many states, we haven't done very well.
In terms of where the party goes from here, Rahul Gandhi, is he now cemented in as party leader?
He always has been, but we have a elected president and he has the final authority on what goes on in the party. But he does consult Mrs. Sonia Gandhi and Rahul Gandhi because they both have been party presidents. But Mr. Rahul Gandhi actually has done commendable work inside parliament and outside. He's walked 4,500 kilometers to send that message of unity. And that has really energized our cadres and the results have shown that.
And of course, his sister, Priyanka Gandhi, is now standing for a seat. It doesn't do much that, though, does it, for the allegations of a dynasty and too dynastic a party to be dispersed when you have another Gandhi standing?
I think there's a difference. No one is forcing someone to occupy a place. We're going to the people. If the voters, in their collective wisdom, 2.5 million of them, elect an individual multiple times, we have to then give credit to the wisdom and the choice of the people. And Priyanka Gandhi, I can tell you, she campaigned relentlessly across the country. And if anyone should be in parliament, it's her. And I'm very happy.
Could she replace her brother then? Could she become the senior Gandhi in the party then?
Well, Mr. Rahul Gandhi has been MP for the last 20 years. That must count for something. And they work as a team. He has actually been the one who's taken on the Prime Minister and the BJP government head on, despite being, put under all sorts of pressures, agencies investigating him. So he's faced all of that and yet did not give up on, his conviction of what he believes in.
What kind of politics are we going to see in India now, given the fact the BJP has lost this sort of apparent iron grip it had on power? What does that mean for India in the next 5 years?
I think the people have spoken. They've said that you can't take us for granted. And to my mind, just having the right to vote does not define a democracy. A democracy is a state where you have watchdogs, you have oversight, you have a robust parliament, and you have independent, credible, transparent, functional constitutional bodies that people have faith in. What we'll see in the future, I don't know. The government has yet to start its work, but it will be carefully watched. We will be a very strong, an opposition that is not just critical for the sake of it.
Beyond those sort of institutional issues, what about the economic ones? Foreign investment has been dropping of late, hasn't it? Does that concern you?
It does, but I think it's just temporary. India has great potential. India has all the ingredients to become one of the top-ranking nations in the world. We already are the fourth or fifth largest economy, but we have to work on the per capita GDP growth because the income disparities are becoming large and we have to make sure that the tens of millions who are not in the economic mainstream are brought in. That's where we have some internal differences. But as a whole, as an export destination, as an investment destination, as a robust marketplace, we are very much there in the global framework and we'll continue to be there.
Final thought on one of the main reasons it's thought why the BJP didn't do so well and why your party did better than previously is because the lower castes in particular felt they were being taken for granted and they weren't sharing in the economic growth. Does this lead to Indian politics becoming more caste-based again?
Well, the Indian political landscape is a very complex one. It'll be very, very simplistic to pinpoint one aspect of it. When you say that people were taken for granted, I know many people in the middle classes, in the urban areas, in so-called upper classes, who felt that things were not right. There was excesses done in terms of the brute force of the government of India being used to subjugate the voice of the opposition. And two elected chief ministers being put in jail, the agencies working to quell the voice of the opposition. Any thinking person will not appreciate that. Indian voters, their depth of wisdom and intelligence, I think is remarkable. They see how the politicians behave, what the government does and does not do, and then wisely, give the mandate. So this mandate really, for me, signifies the far side of the people. So this caste reality, upper caste, lower caste, of course, it has some role to play, but I don't think it's definitive. It doesn't define Indian politics.
Sachin Pilot, General Secretary of India's main opposition National Congress Party, bringing to an end this edition of NewsHour. From me, James Kumarasamy, and the rest of the team, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI,
Aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for People.